From Myersdale to Wellsboro, Waynesburg to Williamsport, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, the Spring 2026 Keystone Business Climate Survey found businesses across the Commonwealth are struggling with inflation and having difficulty finding employees. Greg Moreland from the National Federation of Independent Business is here to discuss. What happens when parents take their sick baby to the hospital and suddenly lose custody without a warrant or court order? Kathy Hoekstra from the Pacific Legal Foundation has an American Heroes look at one such case. And both Congress and the state legislature are on the brink of passing legislation that would increase costs for taxpayers and consumers. Emily Bry from Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania, has this week's Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Greg Moreland from the National Federation of Independent Business in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. Perhaps few issues have spawned more hysteria and disinformation than the proliferation of data centers. One of the biggest talking points used by opponents of data centers is that they consume excess amounts of water. In addition to the fact most of America does not face a scarcity of water, data centers account for less water usage than is used annually for watering golf courses, filling swimming pools, watering our lawns, or even irrigating watermelon patches. The Committee to Unleash Prosperity conducted the research and produced a graphic showing that all of the above consume more water than data centers, an inconvenient fact for data center opponents. Pennsylvania's withdrawal from the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or REGI, has spawned a boom in new gas well drilling. The number of new wells drilled in the state during the past year rose from 309 in 2024 to 444 in 2025. As a result of the new wells and higher prices, the amount paid by gas companies into the state's impact fee fund increased by $244 million in 2024. Those funds are then distributed to counties and municipalities and to defray the cost of certain state agencies. Pennsylvania House Democrats have voted to slash education funding. The House Education Committee voted to cut funding for Pennsylvania's Tax Credit Scholarship Program, which has proven to be popular among donors and provides a considerable funding source for a wide array of educational options for K-12 students across the Commonwealth. The proposed cut of $100 million would reduce funding for over 30,000 students who depend on that program. All Democrats on the committee voted to cut education funding, while all the Republicans opposed the measure. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. The Spring 2026 Keystone Business Climate Survey found the owners and operators of businesses throughout Pennsylvania reporting the state's business climate is getting worse. A number of factors play into that perception. Greg Moreland is Pennsylvania State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. He is here for a look at the state of the Commonwealth's business climate. Greg, welcome back to Lincoln Radio Journal. Greg, as we look at the Spring 2026 Keystone Business Climate Survey, there's one question that we have asked in every survey since we started taking this survey about 20 years ago. And we always ask if the respondents, who are people, by the way, who are the owners, the CEOs, the managers, the people who are actually doing business in Pennsylvania, we ask them if business conditions are getting better or worse. This survey in particular seemed to be very negative on business conditions. Are you experiencing that as you go around the state?
We are. We're seeing business owners in different sectors having different issues. There's a lot going on in the world today that has an impact on the economy and the state of affairs for you know, nearly all businesses. And so I think a lot of businesses right now are struggling with some higher prices. They are struggling still with inflation. They still can't get the employees that they need, the qualified workforce. And so there's a multitude of different reasons, I think, that some business owners are a little bit more pessimistic than others. But I think generally speaking, businesses are doing okay, but they aren't necessarily thriving right now. And so I think if we could unlock some potential for them to just operate their businesses as they see fit without government interference, I think that would go a long way in their trajectory.
It's interesting. Affordability became a big issue in last November's elections in New York and Virginia and some of the other places that had major elections. And so the focus got placed on that. But if you look at this question and the number of people responding who say that business conditions in Pennsylvania have gotten better in the last 6 months is only 11%. And that's down from 18% 6 months ago. So do you see that despite the focus on affordability, we have some things that are still not quite headed in the right direction?
Yeah, I do. I agree there. It's hard to say whether these folks are seeing these issues more as federal or state issues. I think Pennsylvania has a long way to go to make ourselves more business friendly. And the General Assembly isn't necessarily working in that direction. Federally, there are a lot of things in limbo, and there was a long government shutdown. There's the Iran conflict. We're still dealing with a lot of inflation, and a lot of the price of gasoline and fuel has drastically increased. And so I do think 1 out of 10 businesses is saying that things are going to get better. That's a very pessimistic way of viewing things, but I think ultimately it's a very realistic way to view things in this climate.
Yeah, conversely, it's something like 43% expect things to actually get worse. Now, this survey, by the way, was taken during the mid to latter part of May, so roughly about 4 or 5 weeks ago. A lot of things have changed since then. Most notably, we have had, at least at the time of this recording, we have an agreement to bring about an end to the conflict in Iran and a reopening of the Strait of Hormuz. So there has, as we speak, been somewhat of a rally in the stock markets. There's been a decline in the per barrel cost of oil. But we did see that big spike in gasoline and diesel had an enormous impact on business.
Absolutely. Gasoline and fuel is involved in every aspect of our lives, right? Nothing moves from one location to another without energy. And when energy costs are going higher and the demand is higher, but the supply is limited, those prices do increase. Hopefully, now that we have seen a resolution to the end of the Iran conflict, I think we will start to see those fuel costs, that pressure alleviate, the fuel costs to come down. Hopefully that will lead to more business optimism, that will lead to businesses being able to not increase their prices, maybe, you know, keep them the same and or lower them if they did increase them to accommodate for the spike in fuel. But when you're thinking about all the tractor trailers we see driving on the highways each and every day, well they're all operated by fuel. And when the cost of that fuel to get a product from place A to place B goes higher, then the overall cost to the consumer has to go higher to accommodate that. And so hopefully that pressure will be alleviated and we'll see some relief there at the pump.
In terms of inflation, Greg, of course, during the 4 years of the Biden administration, inflation over those 4 years cumulatively went up by about 24-25%. It did come down at the start of the current Trump administration, but now in the last couple months, largely due to that war, it has ticked back up. And we're seeing over a third of the businesses saying that inflation is having a significant impact. What impact do you see inflation is having on small businesses and their efforts to not only operate with a profit, but maybe expand a little bit?
Yeah, small businesses really don't like to raise the price of their goods and services because it drives consumer behavior and it drives them away. But when there is inflation, they don't have any other avenue to go but to raise prices unless they want to eat that cost and receive fewer funds at the end of the year. And quite honestly, small businesses operate on such a small margin of profit that they don't have the ability to just absorb higher costs of goods and services. And so inflation is a real issue. I think most people are viewing inflation through the lens of energy costs and fuel and gasoline, and that may have had a heavy sway on the respondents' positions there. Again, like I just said, hopefully we'll see some relief at the pump there, and people's perspective on inflation will slightly go down because they are seeing some relief.
We are talking with Greg Moreland, who is state director of the National Federation of Independent Business here in Pennsylvania, taking a look at the overall economy in Pennsylvania and the results of our most recent Keystone Business Climate Survey, which, by the way, you can read the numeric results of that at lincolninstitute.org. Now, Greg, we have seen a decline in recent surveys of concerns over government regulations. This is other factors have been more predominant, but somewhat limited, even though we frequently look at the federal and the state government, counties and cities can have an impact on regulation as well. For example, in Allegheny County, there's a proposal to give 18 weeks of paid family leave. Can small businesses absorb the cost of a regulation of that sort?
I have already had numerous NFIB businesses in Allegheny County reach out to us and say if this policy goes into effect, they will go out of business. They won't even wait for the cost to hit them when an employee has to go out. They will start closing their doors immediately and start moving operations elsewhere. I had one company owner say that he is looking to get his business to a certain valuation, and then he is selling it, and then he is moving to Florida, where he thinks there's a little bit more freedom to operate a business. 18 weeks of fully funded paid leave for an individual is unconscionable for a small business owner. Many business owners in the small business sector have about 10 employees. That is what our average member at NFIB has. So when you lose one employee for over 4 months and have to fully pay them, find a replacement, pay that person as well, you're paying two people to do one job. It is not a good policy. There's a reason that the federal government, when they enacted FMLA, the Family Medical Leave Act, realized that businesses with fewer than 50 employees cannot accommodate that such a policy. And so they made the policy of FMLA only effective for folks that in businesses that have 50 or more employees. This policy would go all the way down. If you employ one individual, this policy would be mandated upon you. It's really a shame. Employees are an employer's best asset. They want to work with those individuals on a leave policy and whatever it might be, but they need the flexibility to do so for whatever works for that business. A one-size-fits-all approach does not work. It'll never work, and it's only going to hurt the small business community.
There continues to be a push in the legislature to increase the state's minimum wage. That would also have a big impact on small businesses. Our survey found that most businesses these days are paying well above minimum wage because you just can't, as you've pointed out, get employees to work for that. So the free market has already pretty much dealt with that issue. But there still are some minimum wage jobs. Would that have an impact on certain businesses if that were increased?
Oh, absolutely. The rhetoric that we hear and the false story that we hear that it's a single mother with two children dragging her kids around to both of her minimum wage jobs is simply a fairy tale. It does not exist. I have given my email address and my phone number out many times and said, if you are one of these workers and you cannot get out of that position, please give me an email, give me a call. I will help find you a job that pays you a little higher. Our argument at NFIB is that no small business should go out of business due to labor costs because the government imposed a mandate upon them. If they pay $7.25 and no one applies for their jobs and they cannot operate their business and go out of business, that is on the business owner and that was a business decision on their behalf, not a forcible mandate from the government putting them out of business. You know, recently last week, I just testified before the House Policy Committee on child care. And my daughter is turning two here soon, and she goes to a child care facility 5 days a week. We pay a certain amount of money to go to that facility, and it's not cheap, right? But in talking with the child care administrator there, I asked about this exact question. What would happen if minimum wage increased? She told me they'd go out of business. out of business. 82 kids would be out of their child care facilities because they don't have the staff. The staff would leave. They don't have the ability to increase those folks higher than around the $15, $16 range. And so there would be no compensatory increase where they would get bumped to 21, 22. Nope. They would actually keep them at the same rate because it would be higher than minimum wage, but it's right around that minimum wage. So they would keep them there. Those folks would leave. The employees would leave for other jobs that pay a little bit higher, offer insurance, and the childcare facilities would slowly close their doors after years and years of serving their communities.
Well, there are real world implications and impacts to all of these policies. We have been again talking with Greg Moreland, State Director of the National Federation of Independent Business for Pennsylvania. Greg, give us your website, because there's a lot of information related to what we've talked about on your website. And also tell us a bit about what NFIB does.
Yeah, NFIB.org. We are a national nonprofit, nonpartisan organization. We represent small business owners. And our mission is to see that our business owners can own, operate, and grow their businesses as they see fit, free of intrusive government interference. We solely are dedicated to looking at policy and advocating for those business owners in Harrisburg and Washington, D.C.
Greg Moreland from the National Federation of Independent Business, Pennsylvania. Greg, thank you for being back with us.
Thank you, Lemon.
Kathy Hoekstra from the Pacific Legal Foundation is here to talk with the parents whose children were taken from their home by authorities in the middle of the night without a warrant or court order. They were subsequently cleared of any wrongdoing and are now fighting back in federal court. Kathy?
The Constitution says your home is your castle, and if the government wants to get in, it needs a warrant. But what if the government ignores that promise and takes your children from your home and whisks them away in the middle of the night? No emergency, no danger, and no warrant. Hi, everyone. I'm Kathy Hoekstra with Pacific Legal Foundation, and this is American Radio Journal. Joining me today are Josh Sabe and Sarah Perkins, husband and wife raising two beautiful little boys, and they're American heroes who lived that nightmare, and now they are fighting back. Josh and Sarah, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Well, this all started in 2022. You were temporarily living in Massachusetts, Sarah, while you were working on your PhD from Brandeis University. And a trip to the emergency room for your baby's fever suddenly triggered this hostile, aggressive child welfare investigation. You were sent home from the hospital, but just 36 hours later, at 1 o'clock in the morning, the State Department of Children and Families officials with that office arrived with police and with no warrant, no court order whatsoever, literally took your children. I want to start off by asking how that moment or those horrible moments changed your lives or affected your lives as a family and American citizens.
I think certainly for me, I just always assumed the system worked. You know, it wasn't perfect. But it generally works to keep people safe and families and children protected. And I think I felt in a visceral way the sentiment that I think Ronald Reagan said of there's nothing so terrifying as hello or the government, we're here to help. I think I have a lot of hope that there are constitutional protections and they're real and that they matter. But I think it was extraordinarily devastating when they felt pretend.
Yeah, I think there's some real irony in the fact that we were in Massachusetts, which is where, you know, they had argued against the general warrant, right? Where British officers could just go into your home whenever they wanted to and look for anything at any time. And that was one of the big things that really led to the revolution. And so the rejection of the general warrant, and that was really crystallized in our Constitution, that the government does not have a general warrant. They can't just go into your house. They can't just demand you hand over your kids because they're the government, and that they must have a warrant. And so there's real irony that in Massachusetts, that's really no longer the case, particularly with DCF or CPS cases. They most of the time go into houses without warrants. And I think that's a terrible betrayal of our Constitution and individuals' rights, and often done in the name of we're helping the children. But the people that normally help children are families, not the government.
Right, right. Absolutely. And you, fortunately, you were able to mobilize not only yourselves, but family members and in very, very short order. You fought to get your kids back, and you did. Your family, you reunited your family. The investigation eventually was dropped. You guys were completely exonerated and your case permanently dismissed. And you moved to Idaho, where you're residing now, and sort of moved on with your lives. So why not just end it there? What made you decide to fight back with a federal lawsuit?
Yeah. So shortly after our family was reunited, our story was covered in a Washington Post article, and it received lots of coverage and attention. And I remember the week that it was published, we got phone calls every day, so many phone calls every single day from parents saying, "Where? How do I get my kids back? They came and they took my kids and we did nothing wrong and they're gone." So I don't feel like it was some sort of heroic thing, or I certainly don't feel like a hero, but it did feel like it was like ethical and moral obligation to try to do whatever we could.
I do think we feel like it's our responsibility to fight back as citizens of the country where something like this has happened, to not allow the government to do this. This is simply inappropriate. Government's not allowed to behave this way, and we're not going to let it.
Yeah. And I mean, government, we're not saying that government shouldn't work to prevent, you know, child abuse or remove at-risk children from truly abusive homes, but the government must adhere to its lawful obligations so everybody can feel safe and secure in their own homes. And so with free representation by PLF, you filed a federal lawsuit arguing that the officials behind this experience violated the 4th and 14th Amendment protections against warrantless search and seizure. But convincing the court of this does take time. Your case has been an arduous one. I know that with the depositions, with the discovery and all of that, it has been very time-consuming, and no small thing to have going on while raising a family and living busy lives. What has this legal journey been like for you, and what's kept you going through it?
I think it has been long. You were right. I was deposed for 9 hours, Sarah for a long time as well.
While we were being deposed, they had me watch the entire 40-minute video of the removal that we had captured on our cell phones during the depositions. And most of that video is my little 3-year-old boy screaming, begging to stay home. Afterwards, they asked if I wanted to take a break. And I said no, because I felt like this is why we're here. That video is precisely why we're here. I was terribly pregnant during the depositions. And it was like, there is no other place that I want to be right now than to be talking about this egregious act that traumatized my child and my family in innumerable ways and continues to traumatize families all across the United States. This matters. This case matters. And whatever good comes from it, I hope will be a step towards security and preserving the constitutions for so many families for whom that is not happening right now.
Yeah. As the legal battle continues, your love for all of your children and your principled courage are an inspiration for so many. And I hope that the folks listening to this will be just as inspired as all of us are. Sarah Perkins and Josh Sabe, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today. And you can learn more about this case and all the work we're doing at Pacific Legal Foundation at pacificlegal.org. I'll be back next month with another courageous American hero. I'm Kathy Hoekstra for American Radio Journal.
Pennsylvania's legislature and the U.S. Congress are moving legislation that would benefit big labor unions but hurt consumers and taxpayers. So says Emily Bry from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania on this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
Pennsylvanians are still facing a cost of living crisis. If you've been to the grocery store lately or paid your electric bill, you already know the truth. Pennsylvanians are still paying too much and getting too little. Families are looking for relief. Small businesses are looking for room to breathe. Local governments are trying to stretch every taxpayer dollar they have. So what is Harrisburg doing? Instead of lowering costs, cutting red tape, and making it easier to build, some lawmakers are pushing Senate Bill 908, a bill that would expand Pennsylvania's prevailing wage act and make taxpayer-funded projects more expensive. Supporters call it protecting workers. In reality, it's a cost hike that passes the burden on to taxpayers. Senate Bill 908 takes the prevailing wage system and stretches it beyond the job site. It reaches into off-site custom fabrication work, the shops and businesses that make certain non-standard materials or parts for public projects, and drags them into the same government wage mandates, paperwork, and enforcement process as on-site contractors. Harrisburg would not just regulate what happens on the public work site, but would reach back into private shops and tell employers how work tied to a public project has to be paid, tracked, and reported. Who benefits from a deal like this? It's certainly not the taxpayer, nor the small local contractor trying to compete. It's not the borough, township, school district, or county trying to get the most out of a limited budget. The winners are the big, politically connected, unionized contractors that can absorb the compliance burden and use government rules to box out smaller competitors. When government picks winners in the marketplace, taxpayers always lose. Prevailing wage mandates already inflate the cost of public projects. They reduce competition. They make it harder for small and independent contractors to bid. They force local taxpayers to pay more for the same road, the same roof, the same building, the same repair. Every dollar wasted on a government wage mandate is a dollar that cannot be used to fix another bridge, repair another school, improve another water system, or lower the pressure on property taxpayers. This is the bigger pattern we are seeing from Harrisburg and Washington. More mandates, less choice, more bureaucracy, less competition, more government interference, less opportunity. Look at the Faster Labor Contracts Act in Washington. It's the same bad idea. Government stepping in between workers and employers and taking power away from the people closest to the workplace. The Faster Labor Contracts Act would impose federal timelines on first contract negotiations. If workers and employers do not reach a deal fast enough, the process can move to government-directed mediation and then to a three-person arbitration panel that can impose a binding contract for 2 years. There is nothing pro-worker about taking decisions away from workers and employers and handing them to federal bureaucratic processes or outside arbitrators. Real pro-worker policy means letting people choose. It means making it easier to grow a business, hire workers, complete projects, and raise wages through productivity, not through political favoritism. SB 908 and the Faster Labor Contracts Act come from the same mindset. Politicians know best, government should set the terms, and taxpayers or employers should just pay the bill. At a time when families are still squeezed by years of inflation and higher costs, our lawmakers should be focused on affordability. They should be removing barriers to building, cutting red tape, expanding competition, and protecting taxpayers. They should not be expanding outdated prevailing wage rules. They should not be helping special interests rig bidding process. They should not be making public projects more expensive. Workers do not need bureaucrats or arbitration panels making decisions for them. They need freedom, flexibility, and opportunity. Tell your lawmaker to reject these costly ideas by heading to afppennsylvania.com. This is Emily Bry, State Director with Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, lincolnradiojournal.com and lincolninstitute.org. For 31 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WIYQ AM and FM in Saxonburg, Oldies Radio 610 in New Freedom, along with WMCE FM in Erie, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the cost of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated, Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Frederick W. Anton III Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.